Good afternoon. A tent camp, a shooting, a new approach to homelessness. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with my guests this hour, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Seattle Channel's Joni Balter. Hey, Joni.
Good, happy Friday to you.
Good and happy to you. Washington Policy Center's Paul Guppy.
Great to be here. Thanks.
This week, Seattle's current mayor said the city's becoming divided over homelessness into this uselessly polarizing argument. Ed Murray said he is not sweeping homeless people out of sight, and he is not ruining our neighborhoods by putting in tent encampments and car camping sites.
No mayor or council member wants to put shelter services for the homeless in neighborhoods where folks don't want them. But 66 people died on our street last year. And people are dying on our streets this year. We are in the middle of a national epidemic. We have very, very few choices. We're trying to get people off our streets. We're trying to get people into a safe place and then move them into permanent temporary shelter and then into permanent housing. It's not going to be easy. I don't want to do it to neighborhoods that don't want it. But we have few choices other than to do nothing and simply let more people die.
Former Mayor McGinn, I'll let you finish your sip of coffee there, and then I'll ask you, how should the city help homeless people and protect the rights of everyone else, too?
It is a national issue. It's an overwhelming issue. The numbers from the last one-night count came in. It's up 19% again over the prior year. But I think we know what needs to be done to a great degree. It's about getting the resources to do it. One is more shelter. I think everybody agrees on that. I would say one thing we need to do is convert our evening shelters into all-day shelters, which would also require more dollars. People need a place to stay. There's a lot of data about how important housing first is, and we need to commit to that. You do need police on the streets enforcing the laws. And so we're in a pickle. Everybody knows the policy that the city needs to pursue. It's a matter of doing your best to execute on those policies. And I, speak from facing those same challenges as a mayor.
Paul Guppy?
Well, this just seems like a painfully familiar discussion because I've heard about a crisis in homelessness in America since the 1980s. It just seems like we've been working on this problem forever. Maybe the approach we're taking is not creative enough. Seattle started a 10 years to end homelessness. That was started in 2005 and obviously didn't work either. So I think maybe a different approach is needed. There is a problem of governance, I think, in the city about applying the laws equally to all, to maintaining order in communities and in these homeless camps.
Break that apart. What did you just say?
Well, what I mean is that, in fairness, I think the law should apply equally to everybody. And I think that the mayor should show that he's governing the city effectively, that there aren't, sort of zones or camps that are allowed, tolerated, I guess, where they make their own rules and the police apparently don't enforce the drug laws and things like that.
So in these car camping sites and these tent encampments that they're allowed to drugs and what else?
Right. And that seems to be allowed or tolerated by the city, looking the other way when it comes to law enforcement. And I say,
can we pause and make, does everybody believe that they're allowed to commit crimes?
There's a second element that goes with this.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead.
Because what's different about homelessness and poverty in the modern world, as opposed to historically, is that it's less about housing and resources and medical care, although we need that. But the fundamental problem is often addiction and behavior. So it's about changing people's behavior, their choices, their lifestyle, so that they won't engage in behaviors that are very self-destructive.
And briefly, what's that going to take?
A combination of fairly enforcing the laws for everybody, saying, and if you really care for someone, you don't let them live on the streets. So we have laws in place against that kind of thing. And I think it's a matter of fair governance by the city combined with services and assistance that helps people get off their addictions, deal with their mental health, get the services that they need so that they aren't living a lifestyle that leads to tragedy.
And how are we getting them off the streets? More shelters you're calling for?
We need shelters for them to go to, but I'm saying it's a matter of accountability that the groups that are providing services now don't seem to be producing the results with the approach we're taking.
Yeah.
And there are other communities in Western Washington that don't have the same level of problem, so maybe we can learn from them.
Joni Balter.
As Donald Trump would say, this is a huge problem and very complicated. So what you have to really break down the difference between sanctioned places where people can go and unsanctioned. And that really played out this week. What a difficult week for Mayor Ed Murray. So he's giving a speech. He's talking about how the state and federal government are not helping enough. And that I don't see anybody arguing with that. That make, you know, they need to help more for absolute sure. But then he's talking about sort of how things go at encampments, and there's all but gunfire in the background. It's off by a few moments. So that was
this is the shooting in Soto at this home unauthorized
unsanctioned
encampment,
right? And so there's that way of looking at it. You could also say, which I spent some time with the mayor yesterday, and you could look at it the way he's looking at it and saying it was an exclamation point on his point that he needs more help from the state and federal government. So I think the big fight in the city, as you said, is, you know, are we always going to throw more money? Is more money going to help us? To me, it seems like it's very complicated, but you have to weigh the interest of the neighborhoods very carefully against the compassionate side of Seattle that very much wants to help these folks.
So what would you do differently?
It's not compassionate to provide places where people are allowed to do drugs.
That's exactly right.
Destructive. And I think Seattle has a reputation, probably nationwide, that if you want to engage in doing drugs and other problems like that, there's a tolerant atmosphere that seems to allow it.
Okay, I don't buy that. It's like I think people are moving here of all different economic strata are moving here, and some of them are homeless. They're coming here because it's the West. The movement in the country is south and west, so they're coming west.
My last comment on this, I just quickly, is that as a research analyst, I look at other examples in nearby jurisdictions, and Bellevue doesn't seem to have the same level of homelessness.
Because the services are in the city, so these folks come into the city.
But Bellevue's a big city.
Portland's numbers are going up dramatically. Portland's numbers are up dramatically.
So let me jump in here. First of all, I'm the backup, Joni. The regulated tent encampments and the regulated encampments are, and thank you for raising the point, are not the issue. It's the unregulated ones. And if you're going to sweep people, you know, out of unregulated tent encampments, there has to be a place to go. That's just the way it is. And I'm not buying the argument that somehow or another we need to do it smarter or do it differently. We do. Of course, we can look to other jurisdictions. But this is a fundamental resource question. The numbers of homeless are going up, and they need shelter. And we are one of the richest cities in the country. We are booming economically. And, you know, I heard the concern that there's no room in the budget to find any money. I cut the budget $67 million in the first year in office, and we preserved human services spending. You can make priorities in a city budget. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to either make more priorities or raise more money and actually spend some resources on it more than we are. And, you know, when there's an emergency, you don't just pull the fire alarm and wait for the fire department. You grab a fire extinguisher.
Okay, to sum all that up, I asked for solutions. I heard more shelters. I heard more money. I heard more police enforce the laws in these encampments and hold the homeless service agencies accountable for getting results, which brings me to something Mayor Murray said this week, that there are too many different nonprofits in the homelessness bureaucracy, and they track their funding more than they track their actual outcomes. I thought this week Q13 analyst C.R. Douglas nicely summed up what he called Seattle's homeless service industrial complex.
All those different agencies, and there are dozens, probably 100, are providing different services. They've all got their own sort of executive.
What are we
directors.
Talking? Meals?
Meals.
Shelters?
Shelters.
Counseling?
Counseling.
Mm.
Job referral programs. Mm. You know, long-term housing, short-term housing, overnight housing, you name it. Veterans housing, family housing, women's housing, all kinds of stuff. But it's very fragmented, and it's fraught with a lot of entrenched interests. They've been around for a long time. They've got a lot of sway at City Hall. And you get a system which has grown up to have a lot of inefficiencies in it. And the mayor is admitting that very publicly.
Paul Guppy, does this vindicate your skepticism about government solutions?
Well, it indicates, I think, the character of government, which is government agencies and nonprofits that receive grants from the government can't, by definition, can't be put out of business. They don't operate in a competitive marketplace. I'm not saying that they should. It's just the character of that kind of work that you continue to receive your budget year after year, regardless of what the actual outcomes or improvements that you're trying to achieve. Those two are not together. In the private competitive marketplace, it's no excuses. Either you're being successful in providing services that your customers want, or you're going out of business.
Would there be a way to privatize helping homeless people?
I'm not arguing for that, but I'm saying that what C.R. Douglas is recognizing is the nature of these bureaucracies that—
And the mayor this week.
And that only look at inputs, but don't actually look at outcomes and whether we're taking the right approach to solving the problem.
Well, that is a smart policy pivot for the mayor to do, to say we're not going to just repeat, we're going to check actual outcomes and results. And that is what we should do, because there is a lot of money going into homelessness now. And
$50 million this year.
$50 million
this year. Maybe he could
$7 million from last year. That's a big increase in this city.
So maybe he could defund the least effective group.
He says he's doing that.
And channel the money. Okay, I'd say that's a positive approach.
Mayor McGinn, did you try to shape up and slim down the homeless service bureaucracy?
It was certainly true that you looked at outcomes, and we, under our administration, our Human Services Division, more reporting was required. There was a greater emphasis on outcomes. There are indeed politics around this as well. People can go to the council and get more money. I think the 10-year plan was around that. But let's just talk about outcomes for a moment here. One observation is we keep, I respect Mr. Guppy's approach here, but this isn't about broken people. It's about broken systems. And we've got a vast inequality. We've got a lot of people suffering. And if you're going to measure outcomes, like one outcome is moving people to permanent housing, there's another outcome. How many people are sleeping on the street at night? I mean, it depends what outcome you want to measure. Right now, we're failing badly on the number of people sleeping on the street each night. That's an appropriate outcome to work on that will lead to better long-term outcomes. So you can say we want outcomes, but you really have to start measuring which outcomes and how are you going to get there. And that's actually a fraught policy discussion.
And when you talk about spending more, the mayor in the same breath, actually the same speech, said he was going to double this year's housing levy. Now, the housing levy isn't all for homeless. It's for different ranges of folks who need help, but it does include moving people from homelessness into housing. And also, you know, some folks don't want to leave, will not refuse completely, not going to do it, leave the street for a variety of reasons. You know that. And so that adds to the complication of the situation. Do I have a second for an asterisk on the sweeps? It sounds like they go in and just with the broom, basically, and start sweeping. But there are services offered. It's over a period of time. It doesn't happen like a sweep as quickly, like go in and throw them all out.
We've been talking about a volatile week, a fatal shooting in Soto at an unauthorized encampment, coinciding with the mayor talking about a new approach to homelessness in this city, including some more accountability. And this connects with the complaints from residents, some of whom don't like homeless services in their midst, in their neighborhoods. And next on KOW's Week in Review, we're going to talk about some of those Seattle residents hiring their own security guards, the pros and cons of that in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Can you afford your own police department? Some Seattle residents kind of can, and they're hiring private security guards because they say the Seattle Police Department's not doing enough to protect them and their property. Seattle Times reporter Jessica Lee says one explanation for this trend: social media.
It's no longer the case like it was a decade ago. When you have your car broken into, you call 911, you call an officer, and you have it formally reported, and that report then stays within the police department. Well, now most people are going online, they're sharing what happened to them, they're posting videos. If my neighbor reports a car prowl, my car gets broken into, we're going to go back and forth on social media, it's going to get shares, and now more people who would not necessarily know that that is happening to both me and my neighbor, they're going to know that this is happening, and then their level of awareness is heightened as well.
Okay, so your level of crime awareness is heightened. Is that a good thing or a problem?
Well, I think it's probably a mixed bag here, because what's going on in the city and where the folks are hiring their own police police folks, private security, is in the sort of northern Queen Anne, Magnolia, that sort of area, when, according to the police, the crime increases, a lot of property crime is in the South End. But perception's reality. And if you're a mayor or if you're a resident, it's you're living with your reality. It affects the future for a mayor, and it affects how the residents feel toward that mayor, enough so to go out and hire their own department.
If they can afford it, what's the problem?
First of all, I think it's a good thing that there's more transparency, that people have more information. There are neighborhood blogs now that really keep people informed about what's going on in the community. I think that's good. Also, it indicates the universal truth that people with money will always find a way to take care of themselves. And by the way, that doesn't necessarily mean wealthy people. A lot of times these are just very modest middle-income people, but they're willing to contribute to a community fund that gets more private security in the neighborhood if people feel that's needed, if the police are not doing what they need to do. So this is a completely non-political, non-ideological issue. People want to feel safe in their neighborhoods. They want to be able to jog, to walk the dog, for their kids to walk to school, and just have a sense that they live in a system of streets and homes where ordinary people can walk around and enjoy their community without fear of being victimized.
They could be giving that money to people who are actually less fortunate and in danger.
Well,
much more danger than they are.
Right, but that's why I say this is very much a local community issue about how people feel about their neighborhood.
So a couple of observations. One is I think the social media is making people more fearful is a red herring. And I think if that's what's being told to the public, you're telling them that they don't know what they're thinking and they don't know what they really want.
We've said that for decades. It used to be that 7 o'clock, the 11 o'clock news is making you fearful.
Right. And what I would say is, let's look at the data. The fact of the matter is, despite the spin that came from the incumbent city council members and city hall, violent crime and property crime in 2014 and 2015 are both significantly higher than they were in 2013, 2012, and before. There is dramatically more property crime. That's black and white data. And as I had some experience with, when you go into a neighborhood and tell them, you know, your fears are unfounded, there is not more crime.
Mayor Murray says generally crime is down.
Well, he's not giving you the facts. It's been down since Kathy O'Toole took office, but before she took on the job, crime went through the roof. Unfortunately for the public, you know, all those council members running for re-election, they didn't want to say they were doing a bad job. So there's been no public debate about this, but it's in black and white. I invite people to take a look at the numbers. So there's a real issue about property crime that needs to be addressed. Now, I don't like the demonization of the homeless. You know, most of the homeless are homeless. They are not out there committing petty crimes. But crime does occur everywhere, and crime occurs in the jungle. I actually had to clear out the jungle, and people camped on my planting strip to tell me not to do it.
So Mayor Murray said this week he's the first mayor who's been willing to say that the jungle needs to be shut down.
Well, the fact of the matter is that in 2012, we got reports of gunfire and crime. We sent the police in, and then we went in and removed the encampments in 2012. It's an ongoing issue. As long as you have this many people homeless, they are going to search for places out of view to set up tents. So he's going to have a challenge, and he deserves support in that challenge. You have to provide the shelter. You have to do the sweep sensitively.
But anyway, you say it's legitimate to be – you say a fear of crime is legitimate.
I do think – I don't think you're going to solve the problem by telling neighborhoods that their concerns are invalid, number one. You have to respond to them. I find it very disturbing that there are private police forces. We are one city. We are not supposed to be two or three cities where wealthy neighborhoods get protection and poor neighborhoods don't. I find the trend horribly disturbing. But you do have to at least acknowledge the facts on the ground if you're going to talk to neighborhoods.
So I don't think you go tell those neighbors that what they think is happening is wrong. That's wacko. That's not going to get you anywhere. Also, there is a concern, a legitimate concern, about private officers coming in. I mean, professionally trained officers make mistakes. So the day that somebody makes one of those mistakes as a private officer, that is the day we're gonna wonder about having this. But you can't tell the residents your concerns. Oh my gosh, where'd you get those?
Yeah, they make mistakes. They can profile, well, as police can profile people who don't look right in a neighborhood. Yes, Paul?
Well, I think an important thing to understand is that the private security guards are a symptom. They're a bellwether. They're an indicator of how people are feeling underneath, because I think the leadership of the city, I think, should take warning that if people are feeling so motivated that they'll get together and actually pay what amounts to private taxes in order to get private security, whether justified or not. And Mayor McGinn makes a good point that people, I'm a data guy, but people don't care about data. They care about how they feel in their neighborhood and whether it's safe. And if it gets to the level where they're actually getting together and writing a check and contributing money into a private fund, in addition to all of the taxes that we pay, I think that indicates a real problem with how the lack of confidence, I guess, in our city government to keep us safe in our neighborhoods.
So bottom line, what should you do if you're safe but you feel unsafe?
You know, I think there's a lot of things that need to be done. I mean, I do think it's good when communities come together around things like block watches and communicating with each other. I think it's great when the department is out in the neighborhood working with people on those things. You do need officers, you know, out on the street. And I know that's been a challenge, hiring enough new officers to replace attrition. Maybe that's a job for our new council member, Lorena Gonzalez, to go get some numbers on and hold folks accountable as to what's going on. There's never any simple solution to crime or homelessness. Again, it's about the execution and the city and communities working together and, you know, being willing to be honest about what's happening and what the solutions are. And, you know, you just got to go out and take your lumps if you're a mayor on this stuff, because there's crime, there's homelessness. There's two sides to the issue, and you just got to do your best.
But I don't think we need to be tolerant of it, and by lowering our standards of what we expect about the livability in the city for families and people who live here. And we had a colleague at our office who relocated to the Tri-Cities area in eastern Washington, and he just said, I mean, it's a big, pretty good-sized urban area. And he said it's night and day as far as how nice and how safe the community is. And so I don't think people in Seattle should give up on wanting – neighborhoods that are safe and good to live in. Not just to say, oh, we live in a big urban environment and we're going to have crime. We have to put up with it. I don't think that's the right approach.
Two quick thoughts. Enforce the law in the sanctioned and unsanctioned areas evenly and just enforce it and don't be sweet or cute about that.
Are we back to homeless encampments?
Yes.
Authorized
yes.
And not?
And then another issue here is that in many of these unsanctioned are producing just piles and piles of garbage. And that is broken window theory 101 right in your face. That has to be dealt with. And it has, you know, and I guess we're going to get in an argument between the city and the state as to who should be cleaning that, because much of what I'm referring to is probably a state right of way. I don't care who does it. Do it. Somebody needs to do it.
Are we cleaning up stuff?
Hazardous garbage as well. I mean, there are dangerous substances being left there.
You know, someone put it to me this way a couple weeks ago on this show, that why are we taking pictures, photos of garbage and using it against each other? You know, you could also put on some gloves and walk around and clean your neighborhood up, you know, rather than just look how awful those people are, including my government who allows our city to be dirty. Oh, are we also just cleaning our own neighborhoods?
Well, I mean, I think, again, I'm always interested in history, and it's interesting to look at movies from the past and stuff and how people just littered on the streets everywhere. So there's a fabulous...
My father was responsible for 40% of the cigarette butts in America.
Just, you know, you open a candy
That's
bar.
That's a conservative estimate.
I just got to lean in here, though. This isn't about garbage. It's not about petty crime. What we are looking at is the tip of the iceberg of inequality in this country. There's a huge issues here. And we're paying the price now for decades of policy. And, you know, maybe we're going to pivot to our next one. Things like the minimum wage.
Yeah.
Like building more housing. Things like building more shelter. Things like more progressive taxation are the ultimate upstream solutions to this problem. And as long as we keep saying that the problem is that somehow or another people are too flawed to take care of themselves, there will always be some people who are in that boat. But that does not explain the dramatic numbers that we're seeing here now.
Paul, you're going to have your chance, because in a moment we're going to talk about how these liberal ideas, higher minimum wage and government spending, this is a sickness from which the rest of the state needs to be quarantined, says one of your state lawmakers. That and more coming up on the Week in Review. He's the former mayor of Seattle. His podcast is called You, Me, Us Now with Mike McGinn. Hiya, Mayor. Paul Guppy is here, Washington Policy Center. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, and I'm Bill Radke. In a moment, in a few minutes here, we'll talk about whether it's time to further liberalize our legal pot laws. I don't know whether that's liberal or conservative idea that needs to be quarantined. Is that liberal or conservative?
Libertarian.
Legal marijuana. Libertarian. Well, we certainly learned this week that Seattle's liberal ideas are an illness that must be quarantined, which is how Republican Senator Michael Baumgartner of Spokane sees it.
You know, we have a very radical leftist takeover of the Seattle City Council, and we have some what I call mini-me's popping up across the state.
He is the one who calls it a quarantine bill. He's proposing that the state prohibit cities and towns from setting employment laws. So that would be wages, hours, sick leave, parental leave. So just for one example, in the future, Spokane and Everett could not raise their minimum wage the way Seattle and SeaTac did. Is Seattle infecting the rest of the state? Mayor McGinn, you were just talking about all your liberal solutions.
Well, I just want to say I'm,
those germs are going out through the microphone, out of the radio.
I just want to say I'm just kind of tickled by the whole thing because I always felt like all the white blood cells of the political establishment descended upon me to remove me from the body politic.
Wow, that's vivid.
Whoa,
but
this is too clinical for me.
But I want to say it appears that the whole city of Seattle caught the bug after that. So we're doing the right thing, and. And you know what? Joking aside, what's he going to do? Quarantine working people from the city of Spokane? What's he going to do? Quarantine poor people from there? You know, quarantine people from fighting for social justice? That's just a ridiculous analogy, man. If Spokane wants to do something good, let him do something good.
Here is his claim. Here is Senator Baumgartner's case. Employment laws are things that businesses have to deal with. And when there's a patchwork of different wage laws and hour laws and sick leave laws and parental leave laws, it makes it very difficult for businesses to operate in the state. That's the case.
Okay. So Senator Baumgartner is really never too far from a really bad idea. He has come up with some doozy. Sometimes he's just using legislation to kind of goof around. As the time earlier, maybe a year or two ago when he tried to reduce the size of the Supreme Court because he didn't like the McCleary decision. I mean, he goofs around a lot. I guess he's serious about this, but he has a vehicle for getting rid of this horrible patchwork, and that's called a statewide minimum wage. And what he's proposing now, he can't possibly be serious. The middle class in Spokane is going to be for family and medical leave, and the middle class, what's left of it in Spokane, is going to be
He's from Spokane.
Is going to be for higher minimum wages, and this movement is sweeping the country. There's no way to quarantine an idea from the whole country. So he has his work cut out for him, is what I would say, because he knows as well as all of us that there's a statewide initiative coming up this year that's going to raise the minimum wage to $13.50 statewide. So he's just goofing is what he's doing.
Okay, I'm not sure that the minimum wage is sweeping everywhere because Spokane just voted down a minimum wage increase this last November, and Tacoma voted down a $15 minimum wage, voted against that, and voted for a
12. Did raise the minimum
wage. I was getting to that, okay? Let me just say it.
Rock on.
Okay,
give me
a complete picture. They voted no on 15 in Tacoma and yes on a lower minimum wage of about $12. And there was a community bill of rights in Bellingham, which was also defeated in recent years. So the Seattle model isn't catching fever across the state or even across the country. Senator Baumgartner has a legitimate point about the burden and complexity of regulation on people as they just try to go about their lives, get to their job, run their business, and find out that as they drive from one jurisdiction to another, the rules radically change. And I think that's something that policymakers have to keep an eye on. And having said that, on economic regulation issues like this, I'm okay with local government, democracy, people deciding, because these are not
like the Republicans are supposed to be.
Well, exactly.
I mean, typically you would expect that local control is better.
Right.
And he's saying not in this case.
Right. And
in
the Catholic Church, there's a principle called subsidiarity, which is decisions should be made at the level that's closest to the people possible. You know, now that's a church making decisions. But in a government, the same idea can be good on issues that do not involve basic constitutional rights. So nobody says that Seattle should have its own voting laws and that, you know, Seattle shouldn't be able to enact photo ID and someplace else doesn't have photo ID and one city has mail-in voting and another one doesn't, because voting is a fundamental right. So that's where our rights have to be protected across the board. But on these economic rules and setting the minimum wage, which is a price control, you just pick an arbitrary number, 15, 1250, 975, and enact it in your local area. And I think that local government should be able to figure that out.
I'll go for some nuance here. It's definitely advisable to have consistent rules across the state. But I think what we've seen in a divided country is that cities are becoming laboratories for new ideas. And that's a good thing. And
or very old liberal ideas.
Indeed. So far, those ideas have been working. Seattle's booming. And we have raised the minimum wage.
We were just talking about Seattle's manifest crime and homeless problems.
But you can talk about them both in the same breath because they're both going on.
There's an economic boom, but we just had a discussion about the problems.
Are you blaming the minimum wage for crime
in Seattle? I'm blaming the governance of the city and not being more accountable to the people of the city and making it livable and safe in our neighborhoods.
Well, let's look at the business rankings, because this state was just named one of the best places to open a business and do business.
And there's an economic boom going on. So you're not going to get an argument from me about that. There's an enormous construction boom because they're upzoning the city so that now you can build a six-story building where previously you could only have a one-story building. So there's a cashing in effect regarding real estate. And anybody who owns a small commercial building would be insane to not sell it to a developer. And that's what's happening in the Lake Union area in West Seattle.
That's
creating an economic tech boom and other things. And that's great. Prosperity is great. But it's also having, there are other effects going on in the city. And we were just talking about homelessness. So I don't think we should tolerate those kinds of problems in the city and look the other way just because South Lake Union is all rebuilding. And that's really exciting. I don't think we should put up with that.
I just like the way Paul is bringing Joni and I together on so many issues here. I'm just
okay. Let's not let it happen again.
Okay. Well, something to argue about, Joni.
Yeah, we'll try to solve that by the end of the show. Actually, we will be talking about liberals against liberals because we have an open congressional seat. So we'll talk Hillary versus Bernie, and why should you care who the next Congress member for life is? Oh. That and more coming up on KOW's A Week in Review. KOW's Week in Review, live tweeting at KOW. I think Mayor Murray is agreeing with you on Twitter, Mayor McGinn. He's retweeting your comment that we posted. Social media making people fearful is a red herring, which is what McGinn said. You're basically saying people don't know what they're feeling. So I think Mayor Murray is backing you up. Don't tell our citizens
If you may remember, there was a second part to that, which is people need to take a look at the data because property crimes and violent crime are indeed higher than they were.
Well, Twitter's only 140 characters, so you can't tweet everything.
Get to all your emotions on there. I'm sorry.
KOW's Week in Review. Mike McGinn, Paul Guppy, Joni Balter, and Bill Radke here. 4 years ago, the idea of legal marijuana was exotic. Now we're used to it. So is it time to push it further? Make pot use more legal, more liberal? This week, Seattle City Attorney Pete Holmes said, yeah, we're restricting pot use too much.
Government can lose its way with the best of intentions. It can see obvious problems that we can all agree on. Youth access to marijuana, impaired usage on the highways or in the workplace. Those are all problems that are legitimate areas of concern for government to address. But we tend to come at these things often with a chainsaw to cut butter. We're overbroad and we then impinge on individual liberties. Working out those details, though, when you've had decades and decades of simple prohibition, mindless knee-jerk prohibition, means that you have to really construct these systems from the ground up.
So he is calling for pot cafes across the state where you can eat and vaporize marijuana outside your home. And he wants it to be legal to have marijuana delivered to your home or office. What's the answer? How much pot use should we allow, Paul Guppy?
It sounds like he's okay with more people getting hurt. So marijuana is not a harmless substance. So the more available it is, the more legitimized it is, the more sort of honored it is, the more people use it, and some people are will have very bad effects from it.
But aren't you basically a libertarian? I mean,
I'm not a libertarian.
No? Oh, okay. Free market, not the same as libertarian. You don't want legalized marijuana. Yeah, okay.
No. So, no, I don't think legalizing marijuana is or was a good idea. And from a practical policy point of view, we just recently legalized it. So we still don't quite know what the effects are going to be, and it could be far more devastating than people think. And I guess I object to the cavalier attitude of the guy who thinks we should just make marijuana as available as, you know, bananas or fresh fruit or something like that. But it's mostly just sending a signal to society that this is okay to take this dangerous drug.
Yes, Joni.
So I've written extensively about the new marijuana laws for Bloomberg View. And I can tell you that from the very beginning, actually, one of the things I said in one of those pieces is Seattle would not be Amsterdam. And that reference is all about the pot cafes. They call them coffee shops in Amsterdam. There's more pot than coffee in those coffee shops in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. So this is a step forward. This is pushing the envelope.
I need to put you on pause because I want to point out on Pete Holt, the city attorney's behalf, he was very purposeful with me saying, this is not Amsterdam. We're not Amsterdam because in Amsterdam you can sell your weed at a pot cafe. This is BYOB, as he put it, bring your own bud. But the fact that we think, a lot of us, when we think pot cafe.
Is that really a difference? I think he's being pretty.
Well,
that's why, yes, the fact
I'm really glad to have that distinction. Thank you very much. Because, again, it would not be sold, so not more prevalent.
But that doesn't mean the public wouldn't basically think, oh, yeah, Amsterdam.
Well, one of the key things in the passage of these laws in the four states where they've passed, you're not allowed to smoke in public. That was a selling point, a very important selling point in each of the debates in these various states.
And you would be out of view in these pot cafes.
You would be
cafes,
out of public view is the language of Initiative 502, which was the measure here in Washington. And so that led to the question then, where do you smoke? And I can tell you Colorado is dealing with this as well. The mayor of Denver was wildly against the pot cafes for many years and is now rethinking. And Pete Holmes, who's one of the active people in getting 502 passed, has long wanted there to be a place for people to go. You cannot smoke marijuana in rental cars. You can't smoke in hotels. Sometimes, and then you get into the whole indoor air and smoking thing. So that's why you referenced, Bill, vape or edibles.
Right.
And so, it's a reasonable debate to have. I don't personally feel strongly like, wow, we really need these pot cafes, but I'm not against them either if they can be secure from people who are under 21. Because
that's
the
impossible.
Argument on pot, the argument, they're not going to let them in there. The argument on pot is there's a difference between young people and people who are over 21 in terms of the impacts on them. That's been proven. There's tons of data on that. You love data, so check it. So I don't have a strong feeling, but I know Pete Holmes has been pushing this, and I know that Denver is definitely grappling with the same issue.
All for them, you know, pot cafes. There are people, in addition to the people who live in rental housing, may not be allowed to smoke in their home either. And if we do want to have it more regulated and have appropriate places to do it and inappropriate places to smoke, let's do it. And the other point I would make is, this is all just catching up to people's practices already. I mean, marijuana has been effectively legalized in the city of Seattle ever since it became the lowest enforcement priority.
But Paul is saying it matters to legalize it and authorize it, stamp it, and legitimize
it.
But
matters. We did
and
that.
And many more people become exposed to it because of that.
Let's just be very clear. We did that a long time ago in Seattle. And I'm going to go back to the
I wonder they need a quarantine.
We did it, and you know what? The sky didn't fall. The city's doing great, and it's one of the things that makes Seattle actually something they like. We got craft beer, we got chocolate, and now we got, you know, legal weed. So guess what? And the city's booming economically. So let's just go with the flow here and allow the cafes.
The sky didn't fall.
That's a cruel attitude. I think that's really cruel.
Well, is there any data? Would anything answer the question? Did people
get hurt with drugs?
Well, okay.
And for us to basically send a signal that it's like chocolate is just really lying to people. And
for,
you know, young people
adults.
Get whether they're 21 or not. It's the more we make it common and available and accepted, the more people are going to be hurt by what is a dangerous narcotic drug.
This ignores the fact that in an unregulated world, it was widely available to kids. A regulated world with pot shops that are accountable to the public, with cafes that are accountable to the public.
But a lot of kids stayed away from it because of the stigma and the illegality.
So there are two federal studies that show,
you know, Paul,
it was illegal.
Paul, you interrupted me that time, it turns out.
Okay.
So, and the fact of the matter is, it has been widely available to kids. This is a chance to make it something that we do regulate, that we do follow. And this, I think Pete Holmes is being right. We do have to figure out how to do the rules. But if we have a situation where you say, you can't smoke in public, but you can't smoke in your house, or you can't smoke in your hotel room, guess what? People are going to be in the alley smoking.
Okay.
So let's just deal with it.
So the Hotel Association would like to allow pot smoking in some of its rooms. Do we want to have the reputation, fair or not, the city attorney's explanation aside, do we want to have that reputation as being a place to come and smoke legally?
We have almost
pot tourism is the
handle. We've almost had that reputation for a hell of a long time in Seattle, and really we've been doing fine. We really have been doing fine, and there's more to be done, obviously, particularly with youth. But having it in a regulated marketplace gives us more opportunity
to
do that.
So we're the Amsterdam of the Northwest. We have a tremendous homeless problem, and people are hiring private security guards. I don't think this is the vision that most people have for what Seattle should be.
So one of the issues in Denver where they are considering this is there's a lot of open pot smoking at something called the 16th Street Mall, which I've never been to, but I'm just telling you what I read on that. And so the idea was to bring it inside, the opposite of sort of what you fear. I also wanted to get at the data here on sort of encouraging, inciting young people. So two federal studies that came out at the very, very end of December talked about teen pot use. It's flat. And so, in other words, the fact that four states have legalized recreational pot and the District of Columbia has not changed their use. So I think that's an important figure to keep your eye on.
So we've been discussing new efforts to go a little further with marijuana legalization. Seattle's city attorney is advocating that at a statewide level, you let cities and towns opt in or opt out, but that statewide there would be the ability to have these pot cafes where you can use edible and vapable marijuana, and he wants it to be legal to have pot delivered to your home or office. So we'll see how those ideas fare. We're going to talk about the standoff in Oregon. We're going to talk about the standoff in the 7th District. The occupying in Oregon and the unoccupying of the office of 7th District Congressman coming up. Joni Balter, Paul Guppy, Mike McGinn, and I'm Bill Radke, and we're live tweeting the Week in Review at KUOW. In Oregon, it looks like the standoff at that wildlife preserve is ending with the death toll at one. Four militants are apparently still in the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge, but one of them says they've packed their cars and are ready to leave. We'll see about that. 11 militants are under arrest. One was fatally shot in a traffic stop this week. As it stands now, Paul, what did this four-week occupation add up to, if anything?
Well, a couple of things. It's good, I think, that the government was with shades of Waco in the past, that they took a slow approach. I think that was a good idea. And it's too bad that there was even one fatality. But to wrap this up as peacefully as possible, I think, is a good thing. I think that the protesters made their point about land use in the West. It's hard for us to gauge the feelings of people who live in smaller community and rural areas when they see the government coming in and pretty much unilaterally just announcing, we're locking up your resources, you know, that we're controlling the land. And they live right there. So I think there's a lack of sensitivity by the Bureau of Land Management, by the National Park Service, and the federal agencies that manage these lands. It's also hard for us to realize what huge percentage of states like Nevada and New Mexico and some of these other states are operated by the federal government. And so a lot of it is shut off. And they delivered that message. And then the third point is that, ironically, there's a coincidence between radical groups on the left, like the Earth Liberation Front, who were trying to make their point, and the tactics that were used by this group. They're exactly the same tactics, a certain level of armed resistance, but to convey a more conservative message, I guess you would say, instead of a radical left message.
Joni, what did it all add up to?
Well, I'm with Paul to the degree that I think that this was handled okay. You know, there is the echo of Waco and Ruby Ridge, and the feds just didn't want one of these things blowing up in their face. And so the gingerly, careful approach, you know, probably worked.
And you remember the argument, if these were African Americans, if these were Muslims, if these were, you know, then the government would have.
And I was just about to say that, and you're not supposed to say on the other hand, but on the other hand, I do feel that if these were armed Muslims or African Americans, I don't think the response would have been the same.
Well,
and that leaves me, you know, uncomfortable just knowing that.
The caveat, I think the character of this confrontation is its isolated location. So if this were an urban area, maybe you would have SWAT teams and things like that. But the fact that it was out in the middle of nowhere, I think, gave the government the latitude. And if it was a Muslim resistance group in a federal building in the middle of nowhere, I would hope that they would take the same slow approach.
Mike McGinn, what will we...
I didn't need to interrupt you, though. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
What, do you think what will we take away from Mao here? Will it be a footnote?
No, it won't be a footnote. And it's hard to second-guess law enforcement when they have this situation. I do think that, you know, the concerns about would they have been treated differently or would they have been treated differently in an urban setting, those are real. And I hope we can take the same sort of restraint and thoughtful approach towards these types of conflicts in urban areas as well, frankly. You know, having said all that, I would just say, folks, head down to Malheur, head down to the Steens, and support the people of Burns. It's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world and worth visiting. And there are real reasons why we have wildlife refuges and protections of our natural resources, and we should respect that and support that.
And maybe that's the takeaway, because what also came out is how much people love this land, environmentalists, hikers, birders, and their voices were heard too, just because they came in and said, you know, we give a darn about this too. So maybe that's
sure,
the takeaway.
Huh? I mean, I think the protesters understood that. They were not looking to, you know, end Yellowstone National Park. It's really a matter of degree and management. And these are vast geographical areas. And I think that the protesters were trying to say, you know, let us have more economic access to some of the land while some areas are preserved. And I think that can be worked out.
I'm sorry. The use of the phrase protesters here is bizarre. Protesters are people peacefully marching and consenting to be arrested to make a point and make some news. People arriving on federal land with guns saying, you know, you're not going to take us to your dead or alive. Bring more people here. We're at an entirely different level of inciting violence.
Okay, so
I don't think they deserve the phrase.
Okay. To summarize this, Paul, you think...
I wasn't trying to, you know, honor them. I was just trying to find a neutral word that described them.
Okay,
you can use whatever term you like.
So you think they somewhat advanced their argument?
I think...
Because I hear Joni saying, if anything, what people will remember was how so many people in Burns said, go home.
I think that they delivered the message. That's what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
I don't approve of their method.
Yeah, I just wonder whether you
they
think they advanced
the law,
their cause.
But I think that just as radical groups have done on the left, they delivered their message. Now, they might not be effective in changing policy because Congress still has to govern the country on a majority basis. But at least the controversy did get that message delivered for what it's worth. I mean, I'm not saying that they should necessarily get everything they want, but they got a lot of news coverage.
Final topic here. We just have a couple more minutes. Seattle's Congressman for Life retiring. This week we talked with another person trying to succeed Jim McDermott. King County Council Chair Joe McDermott told me, number one, he doesn't think much one way or the other about having the same name. He didn't say stop asking me, but he almost did. And then I asked him this.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton?
Hillary Clinton.
Easy.
I think Hillary Clinton has an exceptional pool of experience that she brings and has been a strong progressive voice throughout her career. And I look forward to her shattering the glass ceiling.
What do you say to a Seattle voter who says Hillary Clinton not full-throated enough, not a strong enough voice?
I think it's excellent that Sanders is raising issues like that in this campaign. A minimum wage, paid sick leave, all kinds of progressive issues that we as a party need to be talking about and that I have led on and will lead on as a member of Congress.
So basically in Seattle, there are liberals and there are liberal liberals. So convince me that I, as a voter, should care which liberal becomes the 7th District U.S. Congress member.
It's a special seat. When you have a seat like Seattle, where you can have it for a very long time, it's a platform for somebody to do, as Jim McDermott did.
And he's not at all interested in his name.
Yeah, who, as he did, to tell truth to power. Iraq war was wrong. We need to change our healthcare system. And I think that's a special role, and it calls for, you know, I'm waiting to see who's going to try to step up to that role.
Paul, which Democrat are you going to vote for?
Well, the point I would make, I guess, is that democracy is about choices. And also that I think the reason the candidates are being asked who they support for president is there are factions within factions. For a candidate to say, I'm a progressive liberal Democrat, really doesn't inform you about this race.
Joe McDermott, Pramila Jayapal, Brady Walkinshaw so far.
Right. And so each of them has to distinguish themselves in some way to explain what they stand for so that voters can make a real choice.
I don't think the field is set yet. I'm hearing it's not set yet. I think that and I'm not sure if former U.S. Attorney Jenny Durkin is in or out, but I know a lot of people would like her or someone like her to run. And so I think it's still in motion. It is a 25-year opening, folks. So it's it matters, Bill.
Okay, listen, last thing we mentioned, because we're talking about Hillary and Bernie, prediction, who will be the nominees, who will be president? Iowa caucuses are coming out. I'm just getting quick predictions.
Okay. Well, Hillary will be the nominee on the Democratic side. I think that's pretty clear.
Okay, nominee Clinton, president?
It's very hard to say. It depends on who.
I know.
Okay.
But you're about to.
Yeah, I'll put it this way. If Republicans are able to come up with a Rubio or a Bush or a Christie or
a
John
Kasich.
Not a
Trump fan, huh?
I'm not a Trump fan. And I think that a candidate like that has a very strong chance of winning the national election because people are dissatisfied with the direction of the country and they want change.
We're out of time. Give me a name. President
Jeb Bush.
Jeb Bush. Mike McGinn.
Oh, I'm not ready yet, but don't count Bernie out is what I'm thinking.
Nominee Sanders, president who?
It could very well be Bernie.
Joni Balter.
I think it's Hillary over Trump unless something really awful happens.
President Clinton. Okay. This has been KUOW's Week in Review. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel Civic Cocktail. Paul Guppy, economist with the Washington Policy Center. Former Mayor Mike McGinn. His podcast is You, Me, Us Now with Mike McGinn. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, live tweeting at KUOW. Thanks for tuning in.